Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The yield on the 10-year T-note fell today to 3.36%, which is nice and all. But the real story about government bonds isn't who's buying them and what rate they're getting. It's who's not buying. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today the 10th of March. Glad to have you with us. And we are talking bonds today, specifically the world's biggest and most influential bond fund, PIMCO it's called. It's mostly getting out of one of the surest bond investments going. That'd be U.S. government debt. The guy running it says he's a little worried about the long-term future of the American economy. And everybody's entitled to his opinion, I guess. But PIMCO's move doesn't necessarily mean the apocalypse is upon us. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
A lot of Americans keep a pretty decent chunk of their savings in U.S. government bonds. Treasury bonds are supposed to be the safest, most stable investment around. So when Bill Gross, the manager of the world's biggest bond fund, says he's going to dump most of the treasuries he owns, well, you may worry a little.
The reason why it's important to listen to a guy like Bill Gross, what he says really will move the market.
That's Daryl Jones, an analyst with Hedgeye Risk Management. He agrees with Gross that Treasury bonds may be at the end of their incredible four-year rally. Here's why. Treasuries, like your home loan or your car loan, are really sensitive to interest rates. When the economy improves, interest rates go up, and treasuries suffer. So in the short term, say in the next year, the economy actually looks pretty good, says Janney Montgomery Scott analyst Guy Labat.
By selling government bonds, Bill Gross is implicitly saying, hey, we expect conditions to improve a little bit.
It's what happens after that that has Gross worried. All of the treasuries he's dumping are the ones with long maturities, like 30 years. The government has been on a giant spending spree, and it issues treasury bonds to fund it. If the government keeps spending so much, there's trouble ahead, says Labat.
There's a good probability that if Congress is unable to rein in spending, then the U.S. will see a negative outlook on its credit rating in the next several years.
Let's regroup then to talk about the end of the world. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Well, as long as we're talking about the end of the world, you remember the European debt crisis? How some countries over there rang up huge deficits and came way too close to default for anybody's comfort? We spent a lot of last year talking about it. And then the Eurozone and its problems just kind of fell off the radar. Today they came back on. Moody's downgraded Spanish government debt. Same thing happened to Greece earlier in the week. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
Portugal, Greece, Ireland, and now Spain are all in the firing line. Investors are demanding higher and higher interest rates to lend to these governments. Meanwhile, there's political disarray in Brussels. The 17 countries that use the euro are bickering over how to bail out weaker members. If the crisis deepens, it could tip Europe back into recession. And that, says Andrew Hilton of the think tank, the CSFI, would hit the US hard.
What happens to the European economy is important because the Europeans are the largest single market for American exports. That's very important. If the Europeans go into another recession, that will hurt every American household.
He says the U.S. is also grappling with horrendous levels of debt, but it has to be easier for one country to tackle that problem than for the group of 17 separate countries that make up the Eurozone. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There's big news in the world of coffee today. Green Mountain, maker of those single-cup Keurig machines and the little K-cups that go with them, is going to team up with Starbucks. Starbucks will start making single-serve cups of coffee and tea for the Keurig machine. Green Mountain machines are going to be sold at Starbucks. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports those little cups could have a very big impact on the coffee business.
The deal means you'll be able to get Starbucks French Roast or Tazo Passion Tea in those adorable K-cups to brew at home in your single-cup brewer. And you'll be able to pick up one of those brewers along with your Venti Caramel Macchiato at Starbucks. RJ Hadavi directs consumer research at Morningstar.
The single-serve coffee market is a high-growth and highly lucrative market, and by positioning the dominant name in coffee with a dominant name in single-serve coffee makers, both firms look to win from it.
Green Mountain already controls most of the $4 billion single-serve coffee market, and Starbucks is, well, Starbucks. Beverage analyst Tom Perko says competitors like Peet's are likely reaching for a different kind of drink today.
I think they're drinking hard liquor. You add these mega trademarks and the whole coffee business begins to change shape.
The alliance comes at a good time, says Perko. Coffee companies have been walloped by soaring bean prices, up nearly 50% in the last 6 months. That makes the highly profitable single servings all the more attractive.
It's a little bit like the printer business. What you really want to do is sell the cartridges. Once you're able to get people into the fold by buying one of the machines, you make your money by selling as many of the pods as possible.
Green Mountain reportedly sells its $150 brewers at a loss. Not so for the K-Cups. They cost almost a dollar a piece. And there's a lot of potential for growth. The single-serve market has been doubling in size every year. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Well, let's see. Bill Gross says scary things. The European debt crisis returns. Anybody want to bet on when the music's going to be? The big reveal when we do the numbers. Secretary of State Clinton is going to do a little on-the-ground diplomacy in the Middle East next week. She'll be in Egypt and Tunisia to get a firsthand look at things. In Egypt, a month after the revolution, it's proving to be a rough transition. There's been fighting this week between Christians and Muslims and between protesters and supporters of the Mubarak regime. Markets and businesses are still recovering from the weeks of protests in Tahrir Square. So when elections are held, perhaps as early as this summer, there's going to be much talk about the politics of the Egyptian economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the story from Cairo.
The typical voter in Egypt's next election won't be some university-educated internet activist with a good middle-class job. It'll be someone like Mustafa Ali. He's 32, dressed in a galabeya. It's a long traditional gown worn by Egyptian working men. He lives in a two-room windowless basement apartment with dirt floors that he shares with his wife and four kids. A fifth is on the way. Ali earned 700 Egyptian pounds a month as the building's caretaker, cleaning and running errands for the people who live in the fancy apartments upstairs. That's about $115, not enough to pay for food and clothing, plus supply him with cheap Egyptian cigarettes. So Ali's planning to move back to the countryside.
He thinks after the revolution things are going to get better for him, so that's why he's moving back to Aswan. He thinks that he'll probably find a good job there, a governmental job, and he'll send the kids to school and it'll be better.
It's a poor man's economic pipe dream. And any political party that can speak to that dream, held by so many of Egypt's traditionalist working people, will have a good shot at power. The most likely candidate for that is the Muslim Brotherhood, with its social agenda of uplifting the poor and developing the country's resources to help them. Essam El Arian is the Brotherhood's spokesman.
The Islamic economic theories is a mixing between free market and independent development and good distribution of wealth for all.
El Arian says the Brotherhood won't try to roll back liberal economic initiatives that delivered strong growth during the Mubarak era. Policies like privatization and expansion of Western brands such as KFC, Nokia, and Coke. But the group will challenge unbridled capitalism that's allowed a small elite to become fabulously wealthy, while 4 in 10 Egyptians wallow in poverty. And El Arian insists the Brotherhood can't promise help from government or the mosques to buy the support of Egypt's poor.
We are not rich enough to distribute money. We educate and train people to help themselves by themselves, to have hospitals, to have schools, workshop for training.
In fact, political figures across the spectrum blame free market capitalism for widening the gap between rich and poor. Mainstream economists are concerned as well. Magda Candel runs the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies.
If you can afford to pay striking high salaries, you can afford to take a little bit of this and redistribute the wealth and provide people a decent amount of income to keep up with the cost of living.
There are more radical calls to roll back economic liberalization and curtail the role of multinationals. One socialist talked my ear off about how her country imports from California the ingredients for its own national food. It's a bean dish called fool because of free trade. Hisham Fahmi of the American Chamber of Commerce in Egypt says this kind of talk is to be expected after a revolution.
I think maybe in the short term there's going to be that worry about more leftist ideology. But I think in the long run, any government will have to be business friendly. Any government will have to look for investment.
At least that's the hope of American businesses here. Once the dust settles, they want to keep expanding in the Arab world's biggest emerging democracy. Reporting from Cairo, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, a journey from Maine to California and back with a detour through the Great Recession.
I blanketed, I think, every square inch of Los Angeles with a resume, with cover letters. I stayed up after our son and Caitlin had gone to bed, applying for jobs on the internet.
But first, let's do the numbers. That European debt crisis we talked about earlier, oh, it hit American markets hard. All three major indices dropped nearly 2% today. The Dow Industrials down 228 points, finished at 11,984. The NASDAQ carved off 50 points, closed at 2701. The S&P 500 fell 24 points, ended things at 1295. There was also investor reaction to civil unrest in oil-rich Saudi Arabia and a surprise trade deficit from China to complete the trifecta. Energy companies were the big losers. ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP all drained more than 3.5% today. Starbucks perked up nearly 10% on that news we told you about with Green Mountain. Green Mountain up 41%. Competitor Peet's Coffee and Tea, yeah, not so good. Spilled 11.5% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.36%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for the month of February. The Labor Department releases its annual report on the employment situation of veterans. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaks at the second annual Women in the World Stories and Solutions Summit, continuing in New York. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Crude closed lower in New York today, off about 1.5% or so. But seeing as how oil prices are still in the triple digits, that's a little bit of false promise. Gas prices are higher as well, all of which has people and car makers interested in fuel efficiency once again. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports they're finding it in a familiar place, the good old internal combustion engine.
Talk fuel-efficient vehicles, and most people think hybrids, electrics, or hydrogen cells. But alternative fuel vehicles only account for a tiny percentage of car sales. Carmakers know there's an easier way to improve fuel efficiency. John Cassessa is an investment banker who specializes in the auto industry.
The fastest, highest reward, and lowest risk path to a cleaner car is the improvement of the internal combustion engine. And auto companies around the world continue to spend the preponderance of their R&D dollars on this.
He says a new take on the regular old gas engine vehicle can be a win-win. Car makers don't have to reinvent the wheel, so to speak. And they're cheaper to produce, so car buyers can get better fuel economy for much less. The latest example is the compact Chevy Cruze Eco, which went on sale in January. Chuck Russell is one of the car's engineers.
Strategy really was to get a great look and a well-equipped vehicle. They got great fuel economy.
The new Cruze gets 42 miles a gallon. Engineers took the existing Chevy Cruze and made it lighter, more aerodynamic, and tweaked the design of the transmission and tires.
There isn't anything there that I would describe as rocket science. It's just been a very, very tactical, pointed use of technology where it was necessary.
And with a base price of $17,000, the Cruze is certainly cheaper than GM's much-vaunted Volt, which starts at more than twice that. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
John Wiley & Sons reported profits today. The publisher behind the Four Dummies books and Frommer's Travel Guides did all right. Sales were up, as were profits. Back in the day, you may well have used another Wiley publication to get you through a class or two. Cliff's Notes, the study guides. Cliff's Notes have been around for 50 years, so now Wiley is trying to put a new shine on the old brand. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Joseph Costello might just have the toughest job in film. He's taking the already shortened Cliff's Notes to Hamlet and turning it into a one-minute video.
This is like the cliffs of the cliffs of the cliffs.
Costello's part of a team producing 1 and 5 minute digital shorts based on the Cliff's Notes guides to major works of literature, also including Romeo and Juliet, The Scarlet Letter, and The Odyssey. Sales of printed copies of the guides have suffered as more information is available online for free. So Costello is working with Mark Burnett, the creator of reality shows like Survivor and The Apprentice, to produce the videos. They'll be distributed through AOL. He calls them Cliff's Notes 2.0.
What's most important is that these things have utility, that the student is able to like look at a Cliff's Notes video and begin a conversation with that work.
Other study guides and literary sites have experimented with short videos with more or less success. The website LitDrift asked writers, musicians, and actors to summarize classic literature in 60 seconds and produced this retelling of the tale of certain star-crossed lovers.
And then what happens is he gets banished, as Shakespeare would say, I guess, and they die, which is pretty sad.
That video's viewership was also pretty sad. Less than 1,000. Literary agent Ted Weinstein says even if Cliff's Notes videos go viral, they may not drive sales of the notes themselves.
The jury's still out on that. Depends on the kind of book, depends on the kind of audience.
But media analyst Ken Doctor says the videos could be used to sell other things.
If the audience is, for instance, students, which would make sense, and you can't verify it's students, you're not selling them Shakespeare books or history books. You're selling them pizza.
Doctor says one of AOL's new business models is producing content like these videos with ads targeted to specific groups.
When these videos come out, you can bet they're going to be at the top of Google search results.
So is a one-minute video of Hamlet more evidence of the dumbing down of America? Carla Stockton is the author of the Cliff's Notes Guide to Hamlet. She's also a former high school English teacher. To all the critics, she says, relax.
If a five-minute video on AOL gets one kid to go and get a DVD, or better yet, to sit down and read that incredible poetry, I'm all for it. I mean, that's what this is about. It's not a substitute. It's a carrot.
She says Shakespeare would probably get a kick out of these videos. After all, he wrote his plays for common people.
We've made it seem like it's some magical out there language that only a few highly intellectual preferred people can understand. And it's not. It's just words. Words. Words.
That last line is from Hamlet, by the way. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Back in the fall of 2007, Caitlin Shetterly and her husband Dan Davis had it pretty good. They were newly married. They were doing work they loved. She was a writer and a freelance radio reporter. He was a photographer. When the economy started to go south in their hometown of Portland, Maine, they decided to do something they'd always wanted to do, pull up stakes and move out west to L.A. And for a while, things were pretty good until the financial crisis and the Great Recession and lost jobs and no money. Caitlin Shetterly writes about their story and their travels in a new memoir that's based on some audio diaries she did for Weekend Edition on NPR. It's called Made for You and Me, Going West, Going Broke, Finding Home. It's good to talk to you both.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
The place I want to start is, pardon me, that moment in your bathroom in the apartment in Santa Monica where you found out you were pregnant.
Yes.
And you look at Dan and you describe the
shock and fear that crosses his face. And then in what might be my favorite line in this whole book, there was also a little hint of exultation at the corners of his mouth.
That's my guy.
There you go. But little did you know what was coming.
I had no idea, of course, that I would get very sick with this pregnancy and have something called hyperemesis gravidarum, where I would basically puke for 9 months. And nor did I know that the recession would hit our lives as hard as it did.
So there you are, first week of January 2009. You have a brand new baby, but your husband's jobs have all been canceled. He's getting no contracting, no freelancing. The whole country is literally thinking that this is it because we've had the crash in the fall of the previous year. What was going through your mind?
What was going through my mind? I mean, I was angry. I think many of us, many people in my generation anyway, I can't speak for, say, my grandparents' generation who went through the Depression, but we've grown up believing that if we work hard and strive for our dreams, they will come true. And I believed that. You know,
past tense. You're speaking in the past tense. I believed that.
Yeah, I did believe that. Now I don't believe it anymore. I don't know that just hard work makes it. I don't know. I think a lot of luck makes it.
Was there a moment, Dan, when you knew? And I think there was a moment where you said, this isn't working, Kate. We got to hit it. We got to go.
There was one moment when I was in a strip mall in Culver City looking for work. And I had parked my car at the end of the parking lot and started to make my way down the row of department stores. And by the time I got to the end, something in me just couldn't turn around and walk the same direction. I just felt so ashamed that I had a college education, and I felt like all of my hard work didn't mean anything anymore. And I walked around to the backside of all the buildings and walked back through the back parking lot so nobody could see me. I just felt too beaten down and too embarrassed to turn around and walk past the same people whom moments ago I was just asking for a job.
There is, Caitlin, besides you and your husband and your dog and your cat and eventually your son, there is another character in this book, and that's this country.
I'm so glad you said that. I mean, you know, I wrote about driving across this country and how beautiful it was both ways. But also there's this, you know, America reached out to us. And that was what was so moving, is that after that first piece aired on NPR, there were the people who were not nice and who said things that were very hurtful to Dan. I mean, what a wimp. You never should have married such a wimp loser guy or something. But people across this country, good people, reached out to us. They offered us homes. I mean, somebody did offer us land.
Yeah.
They offered us plane tickets. They offered us their homes to sleep in for the night. They offered us food. Americans are good.
Dan, the quote in the beginning of this book, before the prologue, is from John Steinbeck. It's from The Grapes of Wrath. And this is your wife who's quoting this, right? And you know what's coming here. It says, women and children knew deep in themselves that no misfortune was too great to bear if their men were whole. No pressure, right?
I love that you just read that, Kai. That means so much to me because that's the story of the book.
You, Caitlin, characterized Dan as the strong, silent type, the guy who, you say the same thing about him that my wife says about me, which is that he has a hard time not working, that if there's a problem, he has to do something because he can't just sit there. But Dan, you talk, or Caitlin talks about how this trip back east, when you guys eventually knew that it was time to leave California and head back east, you talk about being broken.
Yeah, it's true. And I think what I was experiencing on the way back, one of the things that I knew how to do when our lives were collapsing was to just put my head down. We had a plan, and that plan was to leave, and I had to execute that plan. Mm. So I just put my head down.
And packed all our boxes.
And got us ready to move. And as we got closer to finally stopping, our journey being over, I think it all hit me. I mean, one of the last real stress for me was coming across the country on tires that were the original tires that we had on our car. And we didn't have the money to put new tires on before we left. And the entire trip across the country, that was always in my mind. Like, our tires aren't good. I have to drive slowly. I have to keep both hands on the steering wheel. And
I knew that I couldn't share that information with Caitlin because someone needed to have some corner available for our son. So I told her about the tires when we got back to Maine. I said,
the day we got back, we pulled into the driveway at my mother's. Dan said, I can't believe we made it on these tires. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I'm just these tires. I mean, we were in Tennessee in a snowstorm. And anyway, we made it.
Yeah, you did. And it's worth pointing out that 2 years later on, your son's doing fine. Dan's in graduate school and you sold the book. The book by Caitlin Shetterly is called Made for You and Me, Going West, Going Broke, Finding Home. There's an excerpt and a whole bunch more on our book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. Thanks, you guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai, so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which the promise and the peril of Twitter is on full display. Chrysler, like all media-savvy companies out there, has a Twitter account or two. The main one, at Chrysler Autos is the handle, is used for general corporate branding and marketing, that kind of thing. And also, it seems, for ill-considered personal rants. The person in charge of tweeting that account is now the person formerly in charge of tweeting that account. After sending this the other day, I find it ironic that Detroit is known as the hashtag Motor City, and yet no one here knows how to bleeping drive, except the word started with F and not B. So mind your manners. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM. All three major indices dropped about 2%. Today, the Dow down 228 points. The NASDAQ took off 50 points. The S&P 500 fell 24 points. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time, back here as we do every single Friday, a review of the week's news from Wall Street and beyond. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.